Buzzkillers, you will not believe who is in the Buzzkill Bunker right now with us. It is Dr. Philip Nash. He hasn't been here all year. 2023 has been Nashless, and you've complained about it. So he came in to do this episode today. It's a very serious episode, but at the beginning, I want to say, welcome back.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Happy 2023 to you, sir.
Yes, it's well into 2023.
I know, we have exactly. To say that. We're going to be 2024 for not too long.
It makes a huge difference because as all of you out there know, Professor Nash is one of the reasons the show is a success. And we are going to talk today. This is a big two-part topic, the Nuremberg trials. This has fascinated me forever. I was a super nerd as a kid and actually watched Judgment at Nuremberg when I was, I don't know, 15 or 12 or something. And of course, no one else was watching that. Everyone was interested in Farrah Fawcett.
Except for the Franken family, which does it every holiday,
apparently. Yes, yeah, that's one of the greatest tweets of all time, if you haven't seen it. Al Franken has a thing where he's cuddling up with his grandkids in the holidays watching Judgment at Nuremberg. I'll try to remember to retweet it. It was the biggest event, world history event at that time. But what were sort of its origins?
Right. Where does the Nuremberg trial comes from? Early on, there was a recognition, I would say certainly among the Allies, certainly among the Western Allies, that Nazi Germany was something new and something far worse in world history, right? Nazi Germany was not a conventional opponent in a big war, I'll put it that way. The main impetus for trying the guilty parties came from the United States. And, you know, one of the interesting things about this whole story is there's no roadmap here. There's no guidebook. What do you do about something like Nazi Germany after you've defeated it? And that was an open question during the war. And by the way, and relatively late in the war, that was still an open question. A little bit of background. In Washington, D.C. at first, there was this thing your listeners may be familiar with called the Morgenthau Plan.
Mm-hmm.
Henry Morgenthau was Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of the Treasury, very influential figure. And he drew up a plan to deal with Nazi Germany after it was defeated, which called for the demilitarization of Germany, the denazification of Germany, and also, I've seen this term, pastoralization, which is, or maybe deindustrialization.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've never heard that part.
Oh, yeah. No, that's I think, one of the key features. And that stems from this belief, not just with Morgenthau, but others too, that German industry was seen as a key source of Nazism.
Ah.
So our understanding of that is a little more sophisticated today. But at the time, people believed that you can't just punish the leaders of Nazi Germany, that you have to you have to dig up the roots and you have to completely, you know, we see a similar debate when it comes to the end of the Civil War in the United States, right? What do you do with the conquered South?
Yeah. This reminds me, there's a sort of arms of Krupp thing here.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. We're going to mention Krupp in a minute. So the idea was that was the main plan, right? Demilitarization, denazification, pastoralization, right? In other words, you destroy German industry and turn it into an agricultural society so that it does not have the power ever again to make war on this scale. When it comes to sort of offenders, right, the leaders of Nazi Germany, the war criminals, etc., minor offenders would be tried in the country where the crime was committed.
Oh, so a captain who did atrocities in Poland would be
tried by the Poles, exactly.
Gotcha.
Which, you know, and you can see that was sort of common sense
sure,
at the time.
Yeah.
And major offenders would be just shot out of hand when they were captured, sort of summary execution.
Right.
That was what was foreseen by the Morgenthau Plan. So the Morgenthau Plan, if you haven't heard of it, there's a reason it was never put into effect. In fact, it quickly became very unpopular within the Roosevelt administration, didn't have a lot of support. Secretary of War Henry Stimson then floated the idea of an international tribunal. And the idea was that you would avoid vengeance and you would help launch a new era of international relations governed by law.
Right,
That it wasn't just Stimson. As we'll see, there were other Americans, other American international lawyers, some prominent people who realized that we have to make this victory count. And we have to make it count in a lot of ways, including in the realm of international law. If we really want to prevent this sort of thing from happening again, we have to make clear there are consequences for these sorts of criminal acts. It was part of a larger sentiment to avoid the repetition of war. You see this with the United Nations. In other words, we had the Interwar League of Nations. It failed. We need to do it right this time.
Yeah, right.
So it's part of that broader context. And then also part of the motive was we need to establish a record. We need to just establish this first cut of history, as they sometimes describe journalism. But we need to gather the documents and make sure that we've established for all time what happened, just sort of document it. And I don't know this for a fact, but keep in mind, this is the same time where the United States is liberating concentration camps And people like General Dwight Eisenhower are he's deliberately forcing people to walk through the liberated camps so that, to multiply the number of witnesses, because he already understands there's going to be Holocaust denial.
Oh yeah.
So I don't know that for a fact, but I wonder if that sort of thinking is related. So in the War Department, it was a special projects branch which was given this, and they in September of 1944. So this is at Stimson's direction. They came up with a 6-page scheme, and it spelled out that you would try not only defendants, but also institutions of Nazi Germany.
This was still while the war is going on.
We're still going on. Yeah, this is September. So the war still has, another 9 months to go or so.
September of 44.
Yeah, September of 44. Yeah. And it established this idea that you would implicitly try the entire regime. And the premise of this 6-page scheme was that Nazi Germany constituted one single criminal conspiracy to wage war and genocide dating back to 1933. Gotcha. So it's almost like, in a way, you could think of it as sort of like a unified field theory of Nazi Germany, that it's all one big ball of wax, that it's not this complicated things with lots of moving parts. It's one big criminal conspiracy. In this scheme, the conspiracy charge was central.
Mm-hmm.
And listeners should keep that in mind, because that's going to be a very controversial aspect of this. But, it's 6 pages. It's very compact, very tidy, very simple. And as it turns out, that's going to be both its strength and its weakness.
Right,
because, 6 pages, people will read a 6-page memo.
Yeah.
And they may even understand it, right? And yet, something as big and complex as this, maybe you should have devoted a little more time and thought to it. So this was cranked out. And from what I've read, it's actually an amazing job, considering how concise and how quickly it was put together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're going to have a big trial and plan of this nature, it needs to be larger.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, okay, here we have Stimson floating this idea for the International Tribunal. It's an alternative to the Morgenthau Plan. Is this kind of new? And because I said the arms of Krupp and World War I a second ago, is this something brand new?
No, not entirely. So by this point, 1944, the laws of war are well established, mm-hmm. right? Listeners, I'm sure, have heard of the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Conventions. Those go back to the early 20th century. Those are well established. And I was interested to learn this because I didn't know this. There were some trials of German war criminals in Germany after World War I.
Oh.
And this was sort of the more conventional international legal thinking, which is nations have jurisdiction. And so if they're German war criminals, they get tried in Germany. Now, you might imagine what some of the difficulties there might involve would be, especially considering the attitudes of a lot of Germans after the end of World War I, which we've talked about in other shows. So there were a few cases. It was a very small number. They typically were very minor people. And no one was happy with this. The Germans were unhappy that anyone was on trial, and the Allies felt that this was way too lenient, way too few people were being tried. I think there were no supporters for these trials afterwards. But the scope of what's going to happen in Nuremberg was new, as was the concept of holding individuals to account for the actions of a government. And this is I'll mention this again at the end, but this is one of the key contributions of the Nuremberg trial, is that it helps establish the idea that as an individual perpetrator or an individual criminal of this nature, you can't hide behind your affiliation with the government and say, it was the state. I was just following orders. Exactly. Right. It shades over into that very quickly. But immediately, as you might imagine, all sorts of issues and potential pitfalls arise that could not be foreseen in any 6-page plan.
Okay. So what are those?
Yeah. So there are a whole bunch. I'm just going to touch on some of them. Some of these, by the way, were more or less settled at the time, and some of them are still relevant today and still disputed today or contested today. So first is probably the most obvious, which is the whole concept of ex post facto law.
Right.
Which is to say, and we've talked about this in another show, that you can't retroactively hold someone accountable for something that wasn't illegal when they did it. For example, there's a whole category, as we'll see, called crimes against humanity.
Yeah.
You're creating new law, especially in the context of the German nation. Mm-hmm. Right, under the Nazis, you might be doing something before World War II in particular, which is perfectly legal by German law.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going to try them internationally.
I can see that being a special problem for stuff that happened during the 30s before the war.
Absolutely,
started.
Absolutely. So how do you try folks for things that were not illegal when they were committed? So pre-war acts, or those acts against German nationals, so persecution of the Jews before World War II. Or from another angle, do you even have jurisdiction? Because international law is not the international equivalent of national law, I'll put it very simply.
Okay, so then explain that a little bit.
Well, I mean, there is no world government, right?
Right, yeah.
States are sovereign.
Despite what people say.
Exactly. Yeah, there are no black helicopters hovering over your house right now. And this was the treaty, right, ever since, the Treaty of Westphalia, 1648, the basic building block in the international system is the nation state. And everyone agreed that legally you are supreme, and uncontested within your realm. And that things like international organization, not world government, international organization, those are still sort of conclaves of sovereign states.
Right. And so people can pull out if they want.
Exactly. Right. You're still sovereign. The whole question of jurisdiction, it sort of hangs over all this. A related question is, it's going to be one of the charges, launching aggressive war. Is that even illegal? Mm-hmm. That was heavily disputed at the time. They did, the prosecutors, the judges, the sort of the people behind this project, basically often pointed to the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, which, quote unquote, outlawed war.
Right.
Yeah. As a function of state policy. But strict legal minds would say that this was a denunciation, that this is an expression of the international community that war is bad and not a specific bit of international law.
Oh, okay.
So, for example, it didn't spell out any penalties, didn't really define what constituted aggressive war, those are the sorts of things you would want if this were to actually constitute law, as opposed to just sort of a preference or an opinion. But in case people wonder, like, well, so what was the comeback to this? The consensus among the people involved at Nuremberg, the prosecutors, the judges, their view is basically that international law evolves, so let's evolve it. To me, it's a little analogous to the debates we have in the United States about the Constitution. Do you stick to the letter of the document, or is it a living document? I think that's in some ways sort of an interesting analogy. And so these folks are obviously on the side of, well, you know, how does international law change? It doesn't change by itself, so let's change it. And they would argue that this situation deserves nothing less. In other words, even if we have to hang our hats on something that's a little ambiguous, like the Kellogg-Briand Pact, we shouldn't shy away from that.
Yes. Again, this is the recognition that this is an exceptional case.
Yeah, exactly. And we cannot, this is so bad and so exceptional, we cannot just sort of fall back into our existing habits and patterns and lapse into our existing understanding of international law. So there's another different problem, but still a problem. And they had to constantly sort of battle against this during the trial. And it's called tu quoque.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a
famous Latin.
Exactly. You know. So it's T-U is the first word, then Q-U-O-Q-U-E. Tu quoque. I had to remind myself how to pronounce it. It's a pretty simple concept, which is the way you defend yourself against an accusation is you accuse the accuser of having done the same thing. Like,
yeah.
Basically, you did it too.
Yeah.
Which may actually be sort of a translation. I don't know Latin. Maybe you do. But you did it too. So it's like a can of worms. If we put Nazis on trial for XYZ, they're going to be able to put us on trial, in effect, for doing something similar.
Yeah.
So, for example, we've talked in other shows about the Nazi-Soviet Pact. Really inconvenient fact.
Oh, lordy. Yeah,
the fact that World War II in Europe started with the very active complicity of one of the victorious allies, the Soviet Union.
Mm.
Or what about, you know, we talked about strategic bombing of German cities by the Royal Air Force and the United States Army Air Force. Do you want to go down that road? Because you can make a real good case that those are war crimes.
Yeah, attacking civilians, yeah.
So that's another pitfall here. From another angle, there's the whole concept that this is an international tribunal,
mm-hmm.
which is to say the four big victorious allied powers, the United States, United Kingdom, Soviet Union, and France, they're all taking active part in this.
Yeah.
These countries have different legal traditions. Since you're setting up something,
Soviet Union,
right, you're not just cruising into an existing court, you're creating a court.
Yeah.
From thin air. So how do you reconcile, especially, I mean, you know, there are some similarities between U.S. and British law, but U.S. and British on the one side and then continental law, like stemming from the Napoleonic Code. I mean, they're very, to this day, very different legal traditions. How do you just sort of throw them in together into a pot and stir? I mean, how do you reconcile
that? And then you put the Soviet Union in there.
Right. Yes, exactly. Absolutely. Or particularly a problem when you come to the issue of conspiracy.
Okay, again, which you introduced right at the beginning as one of the biggest problems.
Whereas, it's my understanding, I know nothing about continental law, but apparently at the time in continental European law, conspiracy is typically not a thing. In other words, whether you conspired to do something ahead of time is irrelevant. It's what you did. Did you break this law? Then we charge you with this law. We don't worry about whether you conspired with anyone to do it. And so I think some of the French and the Soviets in particular were a little perplexed by this. And I think also the British to some extent. And then there's the other question, which is this just victor's justice sort of dressed up? Is this going to be a show trial or a kangaroo court? Or is it going to be a foregone conclusion? Or from another angle, does this have any legitimacy?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You can trot out the judges and the prosecutors and the evidence and spend months in the courtroom. But if people think the fix is in, that you're just trying to put a legal gloss on summary execution, then what's the point? Why not just summary execution? By the way, through the trial, there were still people, including some prominent voices, who were saying, like, why are we doing this? You've got the power. You've got the bad guys behind bars. Put a bullet in each one of their heads.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that. Did a lot of these pitfalls or potential pitfalls or legal questions, moral questions, are these being raised by the allies?
Yeah, both in public and in private. In other words, hammering out, and then they have to come up, you know, you've got your 6-page plan.
Yeah, and then
they have to translate that into an actual, in effect, guidebook for how this trial is going to be run. That took months, and all these debates are going on behind the scenes, in addition to be swirling around in the public discussion.
Because I think most people, when they think about the Nuremberg trials, it's this righteous event where the Nazis are hauled in and tried for their crimes, and the Allies are all together on it.
Right.
You know, that this is what needs to be done. It's the right thing to do.
Morally, not at all.
Politically and everything else. Wow.
Not at all. No, and I'm sort of getting ahead of myself here, but that's actually one of the remarkable things about this, is that there wasn't more conflict among the Allies, especially, like, you know, you mentioned the Soviet. They actually did a pretty good job of tamping down and sort of finessing a lot of those disagreements and preventing them from going public.
Mm-hmm.
So you also have logistics involved in this.
Yeah, where are you going
to have
it?
Not to be overlooked, you have to gather, process, translate, and disseminate evidence. And by the way, you mentioned conflict. In the lead up to the trial, there was actually conflict among the Allies. Who has what documents? Who's sharing? Who's not sharing? Like, you want to hold back your best stuff for your prosecution team?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And, you know, it sounds like teenagers, but there's a lot of that going on. It's like, hey, you didn't give us these documents, and they're really useful for what we're doing. Why don't you be more forthcoming?
This is just like Allied rivalries during the war.
Exactly. And in a way, it would be naive to think that it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So I saw some figures. The prosecution examined 110,000 documents.
Yeah.
And if you look, and I think that doesn't capture it. If you look at the amount of paper that's moving around, it's not really logical to talk about pages. It's better to talk about tons.
Tons.
Literally. So we're talking about evidence. If you can imagine documentary evidence being moved on pallets.
Wow.
That's how much we're talking about here. And that has to be processed, right?
You can't just say,
there's nothing important in that box over there. No, you have to look through that box. So we historians understand this intuitively.
That's why we get the big money.
Exactly. That's why they pay us the big bucks. So a lot of these documents have to be processed, shared, copied. Mm-hmm. You know, remember, a lot of this is happening in wartime and immediate post-war Europe. Things you and I take for granted, like the ability to copy documents and type stuff up and having enough equipment and stuff,
not to be
taken for granted. And then there's the trial itself. Remember, this for this trial to happen, it has to have simultaneous translation in four languages.
Gosh, yeah. And
English,
by
French,
the way,
German, and Russian.
When you see the YouTube clips about this, you'll see everybody has headphones on.
Correct. Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't want to go into the details, but it's my understanding that for that to have been pulled off in that place and time was almost a miracle.
Each person has to have a different language coming through their headphones.
Just the logistics, you know, having translators who are skilled enough. And by the way, it's not about being bilingual.
No.
It's about being able to translate, which is entirely different art.
And do it, you know, immediately.
Yeah, immediately. And then you have to have a bunch of them because you can't do it nonstop. So they have to be replaced and you have to have a seamless transition.
Oh, Lord.
And we take it for granted at places like the UN or even online or whatever. Simultaneous translation is not a problem. Back then it was a problem and they immediately surmounted it. And it's pretty amazing.
Astounding. Because, of course, you can't try someone and not communicate them in their native language because that would be unfair to the defendant.
Absolutely.
Any defendant.
Absolutely. And also just, you wouldn't be able to prosecute them. How do you cross-examine someone who doesn't understand what you're asking them?
Exactly.
And then there's the final question, which is, so what's the scope of the trial? How big is it? How many defendants? What are your actual procedures? How long should it last? And they understood at the time that this might have to be a lengthy process, but if it's too long, if it drags on for years, that's a huge problem. People will lose interest. You're trying to make an impact. You're trying to make a statement. That means you should be done in months, not years, because you have to maintain public interest. And because when people's memories of the war are fresh, you have to sort of strike with the iron's hot.
And presumably, in theory, defendants could die. Some of these Nazis are old.
Absolutely.
And by the way, let me just, before we move on to the next question, all this logistics and the gathering and translating and processing of documents, that doesn't even include all the documents, of course, that the Nazis destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So if out of some magic happening, we've been able to capture all the documents, it would have been three times as problematic.
No, but you're right. That is another reason for speed, for sure.
So how quickly did it all come together? All we've done so far, well, I shouldn't say all, that sounds insulting.
Dr. Nash, would you stop wasting our time?
What we've done so far is established how unbelievably complicated it was just thinking about it.
Right.
How quickly does it, you know, all come together?
Not that quickly, maybe surprisingly. Very slow at first. During the war, there was a lot of dawdling, and you could probably understand this, right? You're still fighting a war. Your priorities are elsewhere. And also, we talked about this in other shows, full awareness, both in the government and in the public, full awareness of the scope of Nazi crimes was slow to sink in.
Yeah.
But as the war entered its final phase, there was mounting pressure. Now, by that, I mean public pressure. Public pressure to act. By the way, I'm sure in all four governments, we could have found some people who thought this was a waste of time. And who thought, like, why bother?
Just shoot them all.
Just shoot them all, or not even that, but just like, there's too much effort, it's too complicated, too many cans of worms, not worth the effort, let's just not do it. Now, they would, of course, never say that, but I'll guarantee there were people who felt that.
Sure, sure, sure.
So, but there's mounting public pressure to act, especially after D-Day, right, after Operation Overlord, the Anglo-American, sort of Western Allied, returned to the continent in 1944. Another complicating factor is that the United States, at the end, is going to be one of the strongest advocates for this. But keep in mind also, the Americans are the ones least touched by the war, to put it very mildly, right? The United States had not been invaded or bombed. If you lived in occupied Poland or occupied France or in the occupied Western Soviet Union, you have a real strong feeling about this.
Oh, sure.
Americans, not so much. And there was also this incident known as the Malmedy Massacre, which happened during the Battle of the Bulge, where some, 86 American GIs were massacred by SS units. Mm-hmm. And this got a lot of attention at the time. That incident, along with, once you get to April, May 1945, at the very end of the war in Europe, Americans are starting to watch newsreel footage in their movie theaters of the liberated concentration camps. And as you might imagine, that also really lit a fire under public opinion.
Once you start seeing the starving people coming out, and they may see...
Right, exactly. And the piles of bodies.
Right.
That's not only shocking, but unprecedented to a lot of Americans. In other words, Americans in their heads, to the extent they have any concept of war, it's not that.
No, that's right.
And so it's very, very shocking. And so public opinion in the United States for punishment grows pretty quickly. And then following that, in the summer of 1945, just to cut to the chase, a charter for an international military tribunal, the IMT, the International Military Tribunal, that is hammered out, summer of 1945.
Okay, then why a military tribunal? Because among other things, are there all these crimes against humanity, crimes against civilians, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, and the judges are not military people.
Yeah, yeah.
They're judges. They're from the legal profession. So it's actually kind of a technical question. With the German surrender, May 1945, there is, all of a sudden, no German state.
Ah, of course, yeah. I never really think about that, but absolutely.
You know, Germany doesn't get its sovereignty back until, 1949?
Yeah.
And in some ways, until the early 50s.
Yeah.
So German sovereignty, so quote-unquote sovereignty in Germany, is now in the hands of the Allied military authorities.
Oh, okay.
There is an Allied control council that is very quickly formed, and it is the sovereign power in Germany. And the IMT, the International Military Tribunal, is created under its authority. So they feel like they have to use the word military, because that's sort of the governing authority. It's military. It's people in uniform who are calling the shots in Germany for years.
And I can imagine that, even maybe they didn't think of this, but public opinion would think this was a war, therefore the military needs to finish it off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is a good place for us to take a little sponsorship break. I know it sounds crass to be, having to stop to talk about advertising during something as horrific as World War II, and especially when the sort of images and the evidence of the crimes against humanity are coming out. But this is what we have to do in order to keep the Buzzkill Institute afloat. So we'll be back in a moment. Okay, Buzzkillers, we are back with your favorite professor, who's finally back in the Buzzkill Institute, Buzzkill Bunker, talking to us in this first episode about the Nuremberg trials, which we really should call something like the build-up to Nuremberg. That should be like the title of the show, because it's not yet Judgment Nuremberg. It's not yet the trial.
No, exactly. We can't even judge yet.
But I've always wondered, now Nuremberg's famous for all kinds of medieval and early modern things in German history, but why Nuremberg for this?
Right. Why Nuremberg? Because it's not obvious. And by the way, the obvious place to hold it is Berlin.
Yeah.
Right?
That's where a lot of
people wanted to hold it. In a way, it's a purely physical, practical problem.
Oh.
Most German cities in the summer of 1945 were a complete shambles, including Berlin.
Right.
And you have to have physical space to hold the trial that's intact. And the judicial buildings in a lot of cities were completely destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So Berlin was impossible. Nuremberg was also heavily damaged. It's not like they got off scot-free.
Yeah.
Nuremberg was heavily bombed. But its Palace of Justice in the center of Nuremberg was the largest courtroom in Germany, is still standing.
Okay. Okay.
And it also had an adjoining prison, which was sufficient for the needs of the trial.
I can imagine that was the real
That's yeah. part of it, sure. Although, as we'll see, the number of defendants was not large, but you did have to have other physical facilities. The city, it turns out, had just enough intact buildings to accommodate all of the required personnel, and we're talking about thousands of people, mm-hmm. if you include the mm-hmm. military guards and all these other people. It's also in the U.S. zone. The United States occupied southern Germany.
That's important, too, because
the United States has the resources. Mm-hmm. In fact, I just read about this. Apparently, the British and French were delighted to find out the Americans are like, basically, well, we'll foot the bill.
Yeah.
And they're like, thank you.
Because,
you know, there's a big cost. You know, for example...
The Soviets are exhausted, you know, because they bore the brunt of the whole
thing. Well, and also, the United States military in World War II was notoriously, lavishly... outfitted. We always had the most food, the most equipment, the best clothing, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was much less of a stretch for the United States to do this. We could afford to pay. But it's not just about the accommodations and the physical part of it. There's also symbolic value, which I think you were sort of hinting at a minute ago. Nuremberg is where, in the 1930s, the Nazi Party held its very famous or infamous rallies
mm-hmm.
once a year for several years.
Again, right. because it's such an important center for German
history. By the way, Nazism, its sort of cradle is in southern Germany.
Aryan.
This is sort of northern Bavaria, for sure. So they had their Triumph of the Will, Leni Riefenstahl's famous film, was shot there, right? Super famous. And also, Nuremberg, in the context of the Holocaust, is also very important. Nuremberg is where the infamous Nuremberg Laws of 1935 were promulgated, where Jews are basically denied citizenship. And they define the Mischling, right? The amount of Jewish blood that makes you Jewish, et cetera.
Right, so these are
really, really important landmark in the history of the Holocaust. It was chosen for that reason as well. Nuremberg, for these reasons, is sort of the belly of the beast for Nazism. So it's symbolically.
Yeah, I think that's very, very important because Berlin is north of this. Berlin is very cosmopolitan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And... Well, first of all, I think you're right. The logistics just makes it possible because they could do it. But also, the going to Nuremberg really does make a symbolic difference.
And they were very much attuned to that.
All right. So whom did they decide to try? And more importantly, why? A lot of people are already dead.
Correct. Yeah. And that's a big issue hanging over all of this. The key defendants, the people you really want to put on trial, or some of them anyway, like Adolf Hitler himself, Heinrich Himmler, Reinhard Heydrich, Joseph Goebbels, our good friend Roland Freisler, even.
Mm-hmm. We did a Piece of Shit Saturday episode on him.
We did indeed. But among the living, the prosecutors decided to deliberately assemble a cross-section of institutions and individuals. And that often gets overlooked in this for probably some obvious reasons. But they also put institutions on trial.
Well, I never think of that, but that's true.
It gets no attention. It's the way we process history, right?
Right,
we focus
on
individuals, so logically enough. And the pictures that they show of the Nuremberg trial, it's the people in the docks, Hermann Göring there with his sunglasses on or whatever.
You can't put an institution in
exactly,
the dock.
Exactly, correct.
At least except in theory, cultural space.
Well, that's right.
Cultural headspace.
Right. So the idea, if you're wondering, like, why organizations as well? Why not just individuals? The idea was that you declare them, if it goes right, you declare them criminal organizations, and then that will facilitate future prosecutions of people who were in those organizations.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
It makes it much easier if you can say, were you a member of the Nazi Party? Well, that's a criminal organization. We're giving you 5 years or whatever. But also individuals. And partly the reason you do this is to suggest just the gargantuan scope and the unity of the Nazi enterprise. This still stems from that original 6-page plan I mentioned before. You do a cross-section of defendants, a cross-section of institutions, and that's part of your message.
Right.
That this was one unified, sprawling conspiracy going back to 1933. So, this is where the plan survives, is in the list of defendants.
Yeah, okay. Now, we said a second ago, well, you said a second ago, Hitler, Himmler, Heydrich, Goebbels, a bunch of people are already dead, but I'm looking down the list that you brought in here. A lot of people are still alive.
Yeah, well, and fallen allied hands.
Really, really sick.
Yeah, so at the risk of losing the listener, I'm going to go through this list. It's almost two dozen people.
Yeah.
But I do this partly because a lot of these are not household names. A lot of these people are quickly forgotten. So, and it'll give you a sense of just how they do represent a cross-section, because they're not just in the military, they're not just in the SS, they're all over the place, including in civilian ministries. Defendant number one is Hermann Göring.
Yeah.
Everyone knows him, right? Head of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, head of the 4-year plan. He was the minister president of Prussia. He was the chair of the Council for the Reich Defense during the war. He was Hitler's successor until Hitler sort of kicked him out of the party in the bunker in April 1945.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Even during the trial, he acted like he was the number one. sort of the ringleader.
Wow.
He sort of wore that proudly. Also, Martin Bormann, very powerful person. He was head of the Nazi Party Chancellery. He was, by 1943, you can argue he's the second most important person in the Third Reich, even though he's very much his gray eminence.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes. He was basically Hitler's gatekeeper. He was tried in absentia. They did not catch him.
Mm-hmm.
And for years and years and years, they didn't even know for sure he was dead. They only confirmed his death in 1972.
Wow.
When they found his remains. And there's
they're
pretty certain that he died on May 2nd, 1945, either killed by, you know, sort of the war fighting in Berlin or taking his own life on May 2nd. So before Germany surrendered. But he was tried in absentia.
Mm-hmm.
And, spoiler alert, convicted. Joachim von Ribbentrop, Hitler's foreign minister after 1938. Konstantin von Neurath, who was Ribbentrop's predecessor as foreign minister. And he was also Reichsprotector of Bohemia and Moravia, which are the sort of the Czech lands.
Right.
Occupied the Czech lands from 1939 to 43. Alfred Rosenberg, notorious Nazi ideologist. But for our purposes here, what he was really nailed for was he was minister for the occupied Eastern territories in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And so knee-deep in war crimes and crimes against humanity there. Julius Streicher, who was Gauleiter of Franconia, or Franken, as the Germans call it, which is where Nuremberg is, by the way. Nuremberg is the capital of Franconia. Mm-hmm. Up until 1940. Publisher of Der Stürmer, which was this notorious anti-Semitic publication. And this, we'll talk about this later, and he's going to get his own BOS Saturday, just if I can
yeah, we've already planned that, Buzz.
Yeah,
Killers,
we're going to do that down the road. They see him as an accessory to mass murder for incitement, which very controversial. Hans Fritzsche, who was the chief of the radio division in the Reich's propaganda ministry, I guess I should say, because that's the English word. He was not a policymaker. In fact, this was one of these problematic choices because pretty much everyone agreed that he's only there because Goebbels is dead.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, William Shirer, who, you know, wrote Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, referred to him as Goebbels' ghost.
That's like, very interesting.
Yeah, and...
That's very,
yeah,
very interesting.
And that, it's a little problematic because he was a newsreader. That was it, pretty much.
Yeah, but again, this whole conspiracy thing, you're...
Right, and if you're trying to implicate all the leading institutions, you need sort of a human face for that institution. So that's...
Yeah, and
that's
he's the radio guy.
Yeah. Right, sort of the voice of German propaganda, for sure. Ernst Kaltenbrunner, who was an SS general and, more importantly, chief of the Reich Security Main Office. This was the coordinated, sort of the umbrella organization that included the SS, the Gestapo, the police. Reinhard Heydrich was head of the RSHA until he was assassinated. And, of course, he's like the leading architect of the Holocaust. So this is at the end of the war, Ernst Kaltenbrunner. Robert Ley, who was chief of the Reich Labor Front and as such responsible for a lot of slave labor.
Yeah, and we always forget about that as well. I've never heard of him.
No, and that actually is kind of impressive because I think in some ways at that time people were way behind historical understanding, understandably. I think this is a case in a way they were almost ahead of their historical standing because slave labor, as you're implying, slave labor gets more attention now in the history of the Third Reich than it once did.
Yeah, sure.
Whereas
at
Nuremberg, you've got several people who are there only because of slave labor.
Yeah, right.
And that includes our next person, Fritz Sauckel, who's the plenipotentiary for slave labor.
Mm-hmm.
Hans Frank, who was a leading lawyer, both for Hitler personally and for the Nazi Party, he ends up as head of what was called the General Government of Poland.
Mm-hmm.
So this was sort of the geographical core of pre-war Poland that included Warsaw. This is the parts of Poland that are not formally incorporated into the Third Reich. And this was the epicenter of the Holocaust, basically. This is where most of the death camps were. This is where most of the ghettos were, etc. And so Hans Frank, as the governor general of Poland, was very much implicated in that. Arthur Seyss-Inquart was an Austrian. He was Hans Frank's deputy in the general government. And more importantly, for the folks at Nuremberg, he was the Reichskommissar of occupied Holland throughout the war.
Wow, yeah.
1940-45. Rudolf Hess, who was deputy Führer until he... on his own, by his own light, flew into Scotland in 1941. We still don't fully understand this event. He apparently hoped to use some of his pull with certain members of the British aristocracy to negotiate a peace.
Yeah.
It was a very, very bizarre episode.
But that didn't keep him from being charged. It's not like they said, did that, so we'll let
you
go.
And that's partly because, like I said, there's this conspiracy that goes way back before the war. In terms of, like, for example, planning aggressive war, as we'll see. Then there are also the military chiefs. Eric Raeder, commander-in-chief of the German Navy between 35 and 43. Karl Dönitz, who succeeded Raeder as head of the Kriegsmarine in the war and then famously was Führer for a week.
Right
after Hitler kills himself and right, he designates Dönitz as successor. Wilhelm Keitel, who was chief of the Armed Forces High Command, the OKW, de facto minister of defense because there really wasn't a minister of defense in the Nazi structure. Alfred Jodl, who was also a general, chief of the Armed Forces Operations Division.
Mm-hmm.
So very much involved in planning and executing aggressive war. Then we have some folks in the economics sphere, like Walter Funk, who was Minister of Economics and President of the Reichsbank, and as such, involved in slave labor.
Right.
So also in the economic sphere, we have Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht.
What?
That's his middle name is that American politician from the 19th century, Horace Greeley. I think his parents had some connection with America. Who knew?
That's anyway. Utterly bizarre.
The most bizarre middle name in the Third Reich that I'm familiar
Lordy.
With. So he was also president of the Reichsbank and minister of economics earlier. So not during the war, but for the war. Then we have Baldur von Schirach, who was head of the Hitler Youth. That was not really the reason he was there. He was Gauleiter of Vienna during the war, 1940 to 45, and as such, very much involved in deportations of Austrian Jews to concentration camps. We have Albert Speer, famously Minister of Armaments. He was Hitler's architect at first, Minister of Armaments between 42 and 45, also heavily implicated in the use of slave labor. You mentioned the industrialists, in particular Krupp. Here was a little bit of egg on the face of the people putting this trial together. Gustav Krupp was a famous industrialist, and he was charged. It turns out he was medically unfit for trial. And really hadn't been running the company for some time anyway. He was sort of the big name.
Yeah.
But they should have done some more research before they indicted him.
Was he? He must have been like the son or grandson of the Krupps.
I think so. Because he's very old and infirm by this point, like I said, medically unfit for trial. And then the prosecutors tried to make this right by swapping in his son, Alfred.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. Because Alfred was really running the company at this point.
Yeah.
But... And this is a case, by the way, where the judges are quite impartial. Because the judge is like, yeah, you can't do that. You can't indict somebody and then
say, well, oh,
de facto unindictment and just bring in somebody else mid-trial. You can't do that.
Okay. Yeah, well, I guess that makes sense. Even though Alfred sounds like he was more involved.
I think maybe if they had indicted Alfred from the get-go, he might have remained defendant and maybe even been convicted. I don't know. But this whole switcheroo on the part of the prosecutors was quashed by the judges. Then we have Wilhelm Frick, who was Minister of the Interior, and then also last Reichsprotector of Bohemia, Moravia. Some of his worst crimes were before the war. In fact, very early on in the establishment of the Nazi dictatorship, because he was the Nazi Minister of the Interior in the first cabinet before the Nazis even established the dictatorship, right when Hitler's appointed chancellor.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, there was a 9-person cabinet, and the Nazis got 3 posts, including chancellor and including Minister of the Interior. So he's there to, for example, help ram through the Enabling Act in the German Reichstag, also in the Nuremberg Laws, also for setting up the concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, Franz von Papen, speaking of the early cabinet, he was not a Nazi, but he was vice chancellor early on, 1933 to 34, and then later ambassador to Austria and Turkey. Not really clear why he's there. By the way, in terms of German politics, he was very instrumental in bringing the Nazis to power.
Okay,
no
but he's
question.
Not a Nazi.
But he's not a Nazi. You know, he's an aristocrat, and that may have something to do with it. They're trying to spread the blame, not confine the blame. Remember, that's their mindset. I'm assuming that's part of it, too. I mean, spoiler alert, he's going to be acquitted. And you can see why.
Yeah.
By the way, not only was he not a Nazi, one of the reasons he's ousted as vice chancellor in the middle of 1934 is he starts taking public stances against the Nazis, to his great credit. So we have 22 defendants plus 6 organizations.
Wow.
The organizations would include the Reich Cabinet, the leadership core of the Nazi Party, the SS and the SD. The SD is the Sicherheitsdienst. This is the SS intelligence service, basically.
Right.
The Gestapo, the SA, which is, you know, the brown shirts, the street thugs. And then the general staff / high command of the military. 22 defendants, 6 organizations. The stage is now set for our trial.
Okay, but Professor, you've talked about, first of all, the difficulties of the organization, the difficulties of the ideas of making this happen. But it seems to me that, what date was the Morgenthau Plan again?
So this would have been 1944, middle of 1944.
in reality, it is astounding that the Allies were able to bring this together.
Oh, yeah.
Super quickly.
Absolutely. Especially if you look into it and see all the difficulties they encountered.
Yeah.
It's amazing they got to this stage. Forget about the trial itself. It's amazing got to this stage this quickly and surmounting all of these problems. Absolutely.
I mean, and Stalin doesn't raise anything like we're going to have this in Moscow.
Yeah.
De Gaulle doesn't say we're having it in Paris or anything.
Yeah.
Anything like that.
Yeah.
First of all, very quick, although you did say the U.S. had the most influence, if you will, but it's still just astounding.
Yeah.
And it hadn't happened before.
Exactly. Right. These people are making this up as they go along, basically.
At this stage, and again, Buzzkill, this is part one of our Nuremberg trial show. There'll be part two next week. Do we know much about public opinion? We've looked a little bit about American public opinion, but what about other public opinion in the rest of Europe?
Good question. I did not look in that. I mean, I don't get the impression that there was opposition to this.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, I'm assuming in Europe there's probably less attention paid to it, less news coverage, less awareness of that this is going on.
They're completely preoccupied putting the countries
exactly.
Back together.
That's the thing. I mean, put it this way, Americans have the luxury of sitting down and reading the New York Times and saying, oh, look what they're doing in Nuremberg. Whereas Europe is in complete chaos. There are people worrying about how are we going to put the lights back on?
Right.
So I think that's part of it too. I'm assuming, and I got a sense from this from places like France and the Soviet Union, that there's a lot more interest in vengeance than justice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just sort of speculating. I suspect there's maybe a little more skepticism there about whether this is a worthwhile undertaking.
It's just interesting because, in our very soundbite way of thinking about things in very short terms, it's boom, the war is over. Then Europe is divided almost the next day.
Exactly.
And it takes a while.
It takes years, and that's a very involved, convoluted process.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so this is part of it, actually.
This
is a very involved, convoluted process that actually gets done pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Buzzkillers, I know you're on the edge of your seats because you want to know, you said about this whole thing, but what happens in the trial? Well, we're going to find out all about the trial next week, so we'll talk to you then. So thank you, Professor Nash, for setting us up, for
teeing
us up.
My pleasure.
And Buzzkillers, we will get the trial started next week.